Well, hello there. This is Jim the Keys bartender. I know it's been, gosh, at least a week since I recorded an episode. It was a busy week last week. I know it's always a busy week with me, right? We're doing the opening of the Crooked Palm Cabana in Tavernier for the Almirada Brewery and Distillery, my place of employment. And they did a series of soft openings and trainings and all that. So I was busy doing that. And as a bartender, not a mixologist, the place I am going to work at is it's mixologist territory. And I needed to change my thinking on how I bartend instead of free pouring, doing shot pour so everything's exact. I know free pour you can get to 95, 98%. I needed to be 100% on everything, precise. Because yes, I buy into it. When you are working at a martini bar and the cocktails are concocted with multiple. When there's always multiple ingredients, but there's several of the drinks that have like eight ingredients in it, and they should be precise. I do buy into that. I have to say that I was always of a belief for bartending, you had to use 95. You're going to be within 95% compliance when you're mixing. You're 95% there. And you just need to shovel out those drinks so people aren't waiting. It's a numbers game. But when you're working at a martini bar or an exclusive place, you should be precise. And so when someone orders one cocktail here from somebody, the next day they come in to get the same exact mixture and the same exact taste. Now, the difficulty with being precise. Now, with all that being said, structurally, the amount of ice you use for the amount of ingredients you put in, the amount of ice you put in your shaker, how long you shake it, what kind of glass you put it into, whether the glass is chilled or not, that all should make the drink equal to the previous drink. Like all drinks would be exactly the same composition, the same taste. The only problem is, and this is where, when judgment comes in for people that are drinking it, that people taste differently each day, depending on what they've eaten. Depending on if they had a lot of coffee, if they're using a new type of toothpaste. And as I said, what they've eaten before, if they've eaten something very spicy, you could burn out your taste buds. I think it's something else. Probably over, you over excite your taste buds. You overstimulate, overstate stimulate your taste buds. When your taste buds are overstimulated, if you eat, if you had a couple mints, that's going to affect the way you taste the next thing and the previous drinks you had. So it's rarely, that one thing that you always had. I've had a menu item, let's say not cocktail, but a food item at certain restaurants. And you always try to go to that restaurant following it to order the same item and get it the same way. And a lot of times you think, wow, it doesn't necessarily taste the same as I remember it the first time. First of all, that's the first time you tasted it. And I think that's kind of like an addictive behavior, isn't it? You're chasing that first experience that you had, the best experience, and you're chasing it with another, attempting to recreate it. And you never get you really don't ever get another first bite at that apple. When you taste and experience something the first time, and if it really excites you, excites your appetites in any way, it could be meeting a person, it could be drinking a drink, it could be eating a food or hearing a song. It changes upon the 10th time or maybe the 20th time you have it. There's some people who say, yes, every time I drink a beer, it always tastes, that's what it tastes like, that first one I had. I mean, there are things that you drink that you have to acclimate your taste buds to. So, having things perfect the same way and getting them the second time, you don't really experience drinks or food or your senses aren't engaged exactly each time when you see something. They're engaged differently. And that's, I know, it's my opinion. It's my opinion. So you may misconstrue someone and say, well, it doesn't necessarily taste the way it tasted the first time. It's like a bottle of wine. Bottle of wines vary, but also depending on what you've eaten. If you've eaten some spiced food and you drink some red wine, it's going to taste differently if you ate more bland food. So I always caution people that. But if you really want to get it the best, to be consistent, that precision pours are. I think that's a mainstay for the mixologist. And I know I said things in the past about mixologists. Maybe not. Maybe what I said about them is that there's bartenders and there's mixologists, and they're not necessarily the same thing, even though they share an occupation. But I always consider myself like one of those doctors who. A family practice doctor. And mixologist is more of a specialist. Right? Part of the show for mixologists is the flair they do when they're putting the drink together. Putting it together, much like a couch from IKEA. If you put together the drink well, then you're going to have a great result. If you do it poorly, you're going to have a piece of shit thing. You have to return to IKEA again. Well, that's all I'm going to be talking about that today. And the rest of the show, I wanted to talk about a little video I saw. And I found it very interesting. It was a video on Facebook. And this gentleman, I think he was, they didn't specify where he was from. He spoke English very well, but with a Nordic accent. So he could have been Dutch, he could have been Swede, he could have been a Finn, Norwegian. My missing could have been from Iceland. But his name was Petter, Petter, I think. And he's sitting in a cockpit of a 747. And what he says, and I'm going to continue this through our short break because you know I always do it first. He says, I'm going to tell you what to do if you have to land a 747. Right at then, I thought, wow, what has happened on a 747 where they're asking someone who has no experience flying? I mean, I've had one lesson in a single engine plane, and I flew a couple flight simulators. A couple flight simulators, virtually nothing, virtually nothing. And then when you look at the dashboard at the cockpit for 747, they are still a very busy item. There's very, I still don't understand if they, I mean, I feel more confident knowing that someone has all those dials there, but I also feel less confident. Because I think about all the things that can go wrong. What if this is set wrong? What is that set wrong? There's hundreds of dials and switches. I wish they'd only have like 12. I think 12 is more manageable. How many different areas do you need? You have one for flying the plane and the other for control. You should keep a whole different panel for controlling lights and things like that. But for the operation of the plane, they should have 12. 12 items. But I guess there's a reason why they have, and someone, probably a listener out there, say, "Well, Jim, the reason why there's all these systems out there, and there's all different ways you can control the systems. You know, there's seven different switches for airspeed indicators, and there's 10 different switches for altitude and for pitch, and directionals." Wow. All those things, lots of things. So Petter says, "This is the thing. I'm going to show you how to land a plane if you don't land a 747." And another thing I thought, how many things have gone wrong on that plane? They're asking someone like me to land a 747. It's not, you never see a commercial, you never seen that Holiday Inn Express. With someone landing a jet, maybe they tried that. Maybe they did do a commercial for it and they did a test thing and said, no, that's not really a good thing to do. Having a stranger, someone with no experience, try to land a 747. There's, you're giving people too many ideas. But how many bad things would have to happen where they have to get someone with it? You would hope on a plane, that, I mean, 747, at least 300 people. It's a wide body. Maybe it's 400 people. I know it's an incredible amount of people. Out of 400 people, there's got to be someone with a jet, flying a jet experience there just by accident. Yeah, I flew a jet a couple of times. And, you know, there had to be at least to be five people that have some sort of pilot experience. A minimum, five people. That's one out of 100. Around about, you know, four, let's say four people is out of 400. Well, 400. And that's besides the whole flight crew, you know. So Petter starts out to talk about, with his confident accent, starts showing a couple things. Now, the way he starts out, if it wasn't for all these dials that he's doing, and I posted this on my Facebook page, I posted this. If it wasn't for all these dials, it'd be pretty easy. The presets he was saying, and this and that. He was talking about presets, altitude, speed, and things like that. The first three things were pretty amazing because you're looking at it, I said, "Boy, I think I can do it. I think I can do it. I think I can do it." And then he keeps on going with all the things you have to do. And once he got up to the 152nd step, I'm exaggerating a bit, but it seemed like the 152nd step, step by step. And you'd have to follow it around. You wouldn't be able to remember it. That's the reason why pilots have checklists. They have checklists. They have to go and read it, and someone's looking at the checklist, and the other's checking, the other's telling them, "I'm going this, I'm switching this switch on. Altitude set to this. Frequency set to this, beacon on, landing gear down," all these things. There was tons of it. And then Petter's explaining all these things on his switches, where to set it, you know, turn it clockwise, turn it that. And I'll tell you the two things that made me rethink my whole thing, besides 150 seconds, 157 steps. They do, was when he said to move this lever a bit. It was the only time he referred to this lever, and he didn't say a number. He said, "Move it a bit." And there were things spinning around on the center console, and I just didn't understand that. He doesn't mention anything about it, but they were just randomly spinning around like they were unwinding. Like a rubber band airplane. So he's talking about that. And then he goes, "Oh, you see this button? Don't hit this button." Absolutely, you know, he kind of reiterates, "Don't hit this button because it turns off the autopilot." And he just leaves it at that. "Just don't hit this button." He shows it in a general area. I'll be back in a moment. So yeah, when Petter, I'm back. So we're at the point of Petter telling you this is how you land a 747. And as I said earlier, a lot of things have to go wrong where you're the one, I'm the one in the seat doing that. And I'm at the, up to the point, up to the 150th step. I'm like thinking I could do this. And then he mentioned the lever, the move it a bit. Really didn't go into particular detail on how far to move this lever, which you think would be kind of important if you're flying a 747. And he talked about the fuel a little and talked about lowering the landing gear a bit and the speed and the beacons and the thing and how to set the headset so you could talk to, well, you got to set it to this and you have to call Mayday, Mayday. And you have to remember the airline you're on. This is American Airlines flying Cleveland to Miami, let's say. Your original where you left and where your destination is. And you leave it on the right frequency. I mean, you have to be say, well, listen, at that point when he did that, and then when he said the button, don't hit that button because it takes it off autopilot. But if you, he didn't say, but if you don't, if you do hit it and you hear that, just hit it again. Because that's what he did. And he goes, oh, yeah, just hit that again. And turned off the voice. It says, warning, warning, and just alarms going off. So I'm watching this whole thing and it goes on. It was a long video. It's at least 12 minutes. How to land a plane. And pretty much the thing he was telling you in the end, he goes, it pretty much the plane will pretty much land itself. But the one thing you have to do, because of crosswind, you have to control the rudders and use your feet. And that's how you would control the way it stays in line on the runway so it doesn't run off to the side. And he says, you should be really careful about that. But on the top of the pedal, don't hit that because that would engage the brakes, the automatic, that would disengage the automatic braking system that you have. If you, that would be a bad thing. Once you disengage it, that means if you disengage it by accident, by hitting the pedal the wrong way on the top instead of on the bottom where you're adjusting the rudders, you'd have to, you'd have to brake yourself. Break, stop the plane yourself. Otherwise, and I go, wow, this is crazy. And after seeing all this stuff, all this video of all the things you have to do, 157 steps, and I'm just picking 157 steps and trying to be consistent, but there were a lot of steps, a lot of switches, and it was very congested dashboard. That being said, I was thinking, how would I feel? If they said, well, listen, we got the video here. We just take your time and hopefully everything's labeled the exact same way on the 747 I'm on. Obviously, you say, well, this is an L1011, so it's totally different. Or an Airbus, right? I think Boeing's the 747 and McDonnell Douglas is the L1011. And then I don't even know if they have those anymore. I guess they do because the planes are at least 30 years old. There's some old planes up there. And then there's Airbus. And I'm sure there's a Chinese one. So I'm thinking, wow, how would I do that? I mean, I have to say, have someone's video. You'd have to have someone's YouTube video access or Facebook, right? And just sit there watching and say, play that part again with the setting the radio and make sure the radio is set. Oh, and I have to set the directionals, the left and right, exactly the same. Why would they have a left and right directionals? And when you have to set match them. I'm not talking about signals. I'm talking about how they can I'm not even sure exactly. This is what you have to do. And I say, well, this is a 747. No, this is a 737. Go, oh, shit, that's even worse. Because those suckers, they crash all the time. It seems like they crash all the time. But yeah, Petter was like doing this whole, all the steps and stuff like that. And then Once you land, you're using the rudder, so you keep in line and stuff like that, and eventually you stop. I wouldn't have been as confident as Petter was if I was the one that was landing the plane. I would like to see a simulator first. I wonder if they said that. Can we do a dry run if I was landing a 747? I think it would probably be easier to land a space shuttle. I'm thinking the space shuttle is probably have the less a busy control panel. They love having switches on there. I know they do. It comes back from when I was a kid. If you think about it, kids love a big board with switches on it. You just flip it around. They used to have these games. We just flip a bunch of switches. If you ever see the Apollo 13 movie and stuff, it's just in front of them. It's a bunch of dials and switches. And people are flipping them and toggling them and all doing all this stuff, which I guess you understand. I do understand you are coming in from outer space and you got to bounce off the atmosphere and you got rockets to fire and stuff like that. Same thing for a 747. But yeah, I would really. Is it really necessary to have all those switches? Is it possible? Maybe it is impossible to have anything less. Why there's an maybe because there's so many brake lines and engines and fuel gauges and speed and this and that. And you should have redundant systems. So say and of course it closed down. But do we really need to make them that complicated? Are things made more complicated? If you think about the process of becoming a lawyer, what lawyers actually do? What do what lawyers actually do? They represent you in or represent clients in a court of law. And there's a code of law that we follow. It could be state law, federal law, municipal law. And they study it and they say, listen, this is our case. This is, let's say you ran over, you got in an accident, you ran into someone and destroyed their mailbox, right? And you have a defense, and your defense is you are avoiding someone, a small child who just came down the driveway on their tricycle and right in front of your car. So you swerved to hit that. And you said in sort of destruction of property, and you're getting sued in civil court. All you have to say is, well, listen, I was driving down the road and this 2-year-old came zooming out of the driveway on a big wheel. And I swerved to the right and destroyed the Manatee mailbox of the person that lives there. And it's not willful destruction of property. I wasn't being careless. I was doing it to avoid running into this child. And you say, well, oh, that's certainly a plausible, that's a plausible explanation. A judge looks at you and stuff like that. We find you not guilty. I mean, and the homeowner insurance should take care of the Manatee mailbox. And he wasn't driving recklessly. But in a lot of cases, people feel the need to have a lawyer because of the intricacies of the laws. What's so intricate of it? Why is it so difficult to make an explanation and make your case? Why are contracts so intense and convoluted? Are they made convoluted so they require people of certain expertise to be able to represent, to write the contract or defend themselves against a contract or criminal law. If you did something, if I'm being accused of, let's say an armed robbery, there's one thing. Let's say right now, I was accused of armed robbery at 9 o'clock this morning in Key Largo, and I'll say, oh, I don't need a lawyer. Right. Let's say it goes to trial and stuff. I don't need a lawyer because I have witnesses. I was teaching class at Mariners Hospital in Tavernier, 10 miles south. I was teaching spin. And I have 10 people that watch me, and I clocked in, and I clocked out. And it'll show you that I was there actually at the gym from 10 after 8 till 9:52. And I'll just explain that in court. Well, if you made it all the way to trial, then you say, oh no, you're going to need a defense attorney. Why would you need a defense attorney? Really? It's cut and dry, isn't it? But that's the way it's made more difficult. Are we doing the same thing with airplanes? I know it was all convoluted. The whole, I was doing it to illustrate a point. With technology nowadays, do we really need, I mean, you do need a pilot in case the systems go down. But planes are so big right now. If the computers go down, it's very unlikely you'll be able to land a plane without a computer. Right? When things start failing, if there's no power, it's not that gonna, there's not gonna, they're not going to muscle the flaps on a jumbo jet using manual pushing it, thousands of pounds. It ain't going to happen. So, all that expertise kind of goes out the windows. The more we have, the more we need this. So instead of lawyers, we need computers. And we're taking less ex, you know, we don't need the highly trained individuals for that. I put a lot of thought into this. I mean, what you need is artificial intelligence. That the guy Petter was showing us how to land a plane. He was actually showing us how to do the presets so the plane could land the plane. And there were a couple things you needed to do if there was wind and it was blowing the plane off the runway that you needed to control the rudder. Most of the things he did not show you, holding on to the yoke, putting the plane down, pulling it back. It was talking about this is how you set it out. And he said, why would you need to set any of these if you go to autopilot? Why would any of those need to be preset? Why would you have to preset it by hand? If the computers are able to do 90%, why would you have to put in 10%? It's like, well, you got to be able to do some pilot stuff. I mean, you need a pilot to know where the gauges are it's supposed to be. Well, I'm supposed to hit this one. I'm not supposed to hit that button. This button makes the wings come off. This button drops all the passengers out of the bottom of the plane. I mean, no, they don't have a button for it. There's not a button for the wings coming off, but might as well be if you cut out the engines. Remember that was, it was just a couple of months ago. I think there was a pilot having some kind of mental breakdown. He was deadheading on an Air Alaska plane. I mean, he was riding as a passenger on an Air Alaska plane, and he decided to make his way to the cockpit. I don't know if he was in the jump seat in the cockpit. Probably was because they usually lock those doors. And he tried to shut the engines off mid-flight. You shouldn't be a, I mean, you shouldn't. In a very rare circumstance, you should not have a button where you can shut off the plane when it's running. It'd be like, no, when it's in the air, it's impossible to turn off the engines. I mean, there may be an instance where they need to turn off an engine, but there should not be a button that turns off all the engines. Right? Kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Well, this is Jim the Keys Bartender. I'm going to end the day right there. Just an observation, and I hope you have a great day. Bye.